Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The economy, it's at the top of the domestic priority list for the presidential candidates this campaign season, and nothing motivates people to vote like money. Oh, but the rhetoric, you could cut it with a knife right now. Instead, let's use history as our guide today to see which presidents in the past 80 years has governed during times of plenty and times of perhaps not so plenty. Joining us now are the co-authors of a new book on the topic. The name of the book is called Bulls, Bears, and the Ballot Box: How the Performance of Our Presidents Has Impacted Your Wallet. Bob Dietrich is co-owner of Polaris Financial Partners in Central Ohio. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Pleasure to be here, Ann. It is Dietrich, by the way.
Okay.
Thank you very much for, I spend half my life spelling and pronouncing that last name, but thank you for having us.
Put the mark over the E there. Okay, and Lou Goldfarb, a CPA and professor at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. Lou, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having us.
And also with us is Bob's partner in business, Steve Morgan, who did some of the research. He's an analyst. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
So, first of all, one of the premises for the book is that no one's ever really done this before. You were preparing a presentation for clients, or you were asked to do a presentation, and in the process of doing that, you discover that no one's really looked back in history to see how presidents have done. I was surprised at that. But in any event, what difference does it make to look backward when it comes to the economy or what an individual president has done or has not done? Isn't it what's coming ahead that's more important? Bob?
Well, with all due respect, we believe in this notion that history is very important. And history is not a guarantee of the future, but it is our best predictor of the future. When Stephen and I, in our practice, when we pick a stock or a bond or a mutual fund or an ETF for a client, we also look at history. We look at the peer group ranking historically of that particular product. We look at the alpha of the fund, which is the risk-adjusted return. We look at the beta or the risk of the fund. We look at the standard deviation. We look at all these historical facts because they aren't a guarantee, but they are the best predictor we have looking forward as well. We really believe that the same is true for our presidents.
So ultimately, presidents hold a slot in history. And to what extent does just the luck of the draw play a role in it, do you think, Lou Goldfarb?
Well, I think we believe that the president can make their own luck, that, the president reacts to the situation they inherit. They advance policies in reaction to what's going on in the world, what's going on in the country. So we firmly believe that luck is not a big part of how the president performs. It's really based upon how the president reacts to the situation they've inherited and the policies they advance.
You looked at an 80-year time period for the book, which luckily had Democrats and Republicans in the Oval Office an equal amount of time, 40 years each. But that in and of itself doesn't necessarily make it scientific, right? I mean, as far as looking back over time.
No, it's not scientific from the standpoint of knowing that. You're right, it's not scientific. But at the end of the day, we felt that made that 40 years for each set of presidents was a good time horizon to look at, from the standpoint that 40 years is really the amount of time that we have toward retirement, to save toward retirement. So we thought that made it a very realistic time frame to look at.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new book. It's called Bulls, Bears, and the Ballot Box: How the Performance of Our Presidents Has Impacted Your Wallet. If you have a question or comment for the authors, Bob Dietrich and Lou Goldfarb, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page or post your question or comment on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. Okay, so the foundation for your book rests on the study and your study of Mariner Stoddard Eccles. He was the first Federal Reserve Chairman. You call this banker, entrepreneur, and Republican an unsung hero. How so is he an unsung hero? Lou or Bob? Bob?
Most people don't know who he is. In fact, when we go out and speak at different audiences about our book and we ask the question, does anyone know who Mariner Eccles was? The answer generally is no, or maybe people have vaguely heard of him. But he was, in our view, probably one of the most important characters, economically speaking, in the 20th century. He was the Warren Buffett of his day back in the early 1930s. But unlike a lot of wealthier people today, his belief was that we had to fix the problems in the economy, and he decided to put the notion of making money aside and capitalism aside to come to Washington to do what he felt was best for the country. And we think that that was really, he really defined the word statesmanship, in our view.
His name was sounding familiar to me, and I understood why when I read that it was his ideas that brought us to the Glass-Steagall Act. I thought that was kind of interesting since that has been such a big point of discussion. Lou Goldfarb, can you talk about that and his relationship with that?
With the Glass-Steagall
Yes.
Act? Yeah, he recognized that, you know, we really needed to separate the investment functions of banks from the banking functions, and knew that that was important to the economy. And it was in place for a number of years until it was repealed in the late 90s. And I think we've seen the effects of the repeal of Glass-Steagall over the last, what happened in 2007, 2008, I think was partially due to the fact that Glass-Steagall was no longer in place.
What else about him, Bob, drove you to make his work the foundation for the book?
Well, he also was the founder of the Banking Act. He was the one that believed in the notion that to fix the Federal Reserve, which was a real problem in the beginning of the Great Depression, that we needed to centralize the Fed in Washington, D.C. and make it a total independent arm that was independent of the Treasury. He also brought up and created the notion of the FHA, or the Federal Housing Administration. That was his idea. He came up with this notion. One of the reasons why we had problems in the Great Depression was that when you went to borrow money to buy a house in the 20s and early 30s, you had to pay the loan back in 5 years, and you had to put 50% down. Well, how many people could afford to do that today? The answer is very, very few. He came up with this notion that through a little bit of government leverage, the government could put aside an insurance fund of 1%. That would allow the banks to go out and lend money out for 30 years instead of 5, and the down payment would be 20-80 instead of 50-50. That allowed hundreds of thousands, millions of more Americans to go out and borrow money for a home, and that helped fuel the recovery from the Great Depression in the early to mid-30s.
Actually, when I was reading about that in your book, it reminded me of a conversation I had last week with somebody about the economy in Mexico, and why they have such a hard time growing the economy in Mexico is because it's so hard to get cheap credit and long-term money to borrow.
But again, that was Eccles' idea, which was a brilliant idea. He also was the father of a lot of the alphabet soup programs. He really believed in this notion of the WPA and the CCC, and he believed in this notion that the government could have a dramatic impact on the economy if it got involved and got money back in the hands of people who would spend it, because he realized that the problem in the early 30s was a demand problem, not a supply problem.
Well, and yet he was a Republican. You make that point at
correct.
The front end. But
correct.
Which brings me to another question is, what a Republican is and what a Democrat is, for that matter, has changed so much over time. Does it really matter to put him in those kind of categories after the course of 80 years? Lou?
Well, I mean, I think as long as we have a two-party system and we have a Republican running on a Republican platform and we have a Democrat running on the Democratic platform, it makes a big difference. Because, I mean, they have two different philosophies about how this country should be governed. And we're hoping, you know, with the information in our book, people will understand the facts, be able to separate the facts from fiction, and make an informed vote. And perhaps for the first time, make the economy a priority when they vote in November. That's one of the goals of our book.
When I started, I thought maybe it would end up being, there's 40 years for the Democrats, 40 years for the Republican. Half of them did it half the time kind of a thing. It didn't turn out that way. And we'll talk about how it did turn out in terms of your analysis. But first, let's take a call real quick. Satish in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
My comment is basically regarding the current situation.
Mm-hmm.
Since Obama took over, the stock market has doubled. And naturally, it leads to some kind of wealth effect. But, and some of the people who are really unhappy, I found out, or some of the people I talked to, they got scared during the financial crisis in 2008, and they converted all their 401k or even savings into the cash. And
right.
Unfortunately, it was they did it at a lower price. So when the stock market started taking off, they were really afraid to get back into it. So,
well, even I know you buy low and you sell high, but my guests are in the studio nodding their heads when you make the point that the stock market doubled the day President Obama took power. Thanks a lot for that call, Satish.
Thank you.
Take care.
If I can make one point in response to what Satish says, the stock market has doubled under Barack Obama, and in fact, looking back 80 years, the stock market under Barack Obama has performed better than any president other than Bill Clinton up to this point. And also in our study, we point out that corporate profits, in fact, have grown more under Barack Obama than any preceding president over the last 80 years.
And yet,
so it's interesting.
Corporate profits have grown, but we've talked about this before on the show. They're just sitting on them right now, right?
They are sitting on them, and there's a lot of speculation as to why that is. I mean, some people speculate they're waiting till, you know, President Romney comes into office. But I got to believe that as businessmen and businesswomen, that if there was demand for products and services, they would reinvest. And I think the problem may be that personal disposable income, which is another statistic we look at in our book, it has gone down under Barack Obama. It's gone down slightly under Barack Obama. There's just not enough, as Bob pointed out earlier, Mariner Eccles recognized you need to have money in the hands of the middle class in order to make the economy work. And when disposable income is down, the economy doesn't work nearly as well.
And they're always talking about the middle class during the elections. Who's done a better job of putting money in the hands of the middle class? Bob?
Over the course of time, it's been the Democrats and not the Republicans. And that may come as a surprise to some, but that's the reality of the situation. In 1929, one of the problems that we had was that 42% of the wealth in the country and was in the hands of the top 1%. And what Mariner Eccles realized at that time was that there was a problem with the velocity of money. One thing that makes a free market system work is that money has to be flowing through the system continuously at all times. When you have so much money at the top, it's hoarded and saved and not invested or not spent, if you will, it slows down the entire economy. And Eccles realized that was a big problem that caused the Great Depression.
I'm talking with Bob Detrick and Lou Goldfarb. They are co-authors of the book Bulls, Bears, and the Ballot Box, How the Performance of Our Presidents Has Impacted Your Wallet. Also with us, Steve Morgan. He's a research analyst and co-owner with Bob Detrick of Polaris Financial Partners. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Mitt Romney called Russia America's number one enemy. Russia does have a new leader, or an old leader back again, Vladimir Putin, and elections in several former Soviet states could give Russia a chance to recapture some of its dominance. I'm David Greene, What Russia Wants, plus baseball, let the playoffs begin. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 63 degrees with cloudy skies. Expect scattered showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Some storms could be severe, a high of 76. More rain for tonight, along with a pop-up thunderstorm, a low of 59. Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's John Glenn School of Public Affairs, offering continuing education and graduate degree programs designed for the working professional. More details about the programs and upcoming information sessions are online at glenn.osu.edu. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about the book Bulls, Bears, and the Ballot Box, How the Performance of Our Presidents Has Impacted Your Wallet. If you have a question or comment for the authors, they're with me here in the studio, Bob Detrick and Lou Goldfarb. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We were talking about Mariner Eccles earlier. He was the first Federal Reserve chairman. You give him a lot of credit, call him an unsung hero. He was a banker, an entrepreneur, one of the mega millionaires of his day. He was also responsible for three pretty important things in tandem with the FHA, stuff many of us really take for granted nowadays, the Glass-Steagall Act and more. But if a Democrat had not hired him on as an advisor in general, but also the first Federal Reserve chairman, whatever he had to contribute might not have been. And of course, that was Franklin Roosevelt. Bob?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that our book talks about and considerably is this notion of pragmatism and compromise. And what was so great about FDR is he saw this man who was very intelligent and one of the most brilliant people of his day and decided that despite the fact that he didn't have the same party affiliation as FDR did, Eccles was a Republican from Utah, he would bring him into his cabinet. He hired him in Treasury for about 18 months. Then he recruited him to become the first Fed chairman, which was exceptional in that day to have a Democrat recruit a Republican to such a leading role. So that goes back to this notion of we've got to get back to this notion of compromise and pragmatism.
So much of what party you're in is defined by what your philosophy is on the economy. Did he have, at the time, was he going against the tide of his own party? Or were Republicans different back then?
No, he was definitely going against the tide of his own party. Most Republicans at the time thought the way to get out of the Great Depression was to balance our budget. That's what most advised FDR. Mariner Eccles was one of the few and maybe the only one who said, no, in a recessionary time, balancing the budget does not work.
What made him a Republican then?
That's a good question. That's a good question. He chose to be a Republican. And I think his family were Republicans also. So, you know, a lot of times, as we all can vouch for, we kind of choose the party that we grew up in. It's kind of DNA. Mm-hmm. It's part of our family. And I think that may have been the same thing for Mariner Eccles.
Okay. And he was born in Utah, which is one of the reddest states that there is.
Even back then.
Yeah, even then.
Okay, so you, through him, developed your presidential rules for economic success. These are some basic rules that you thought when people fall into these categories, they tend to have been successful with the economy as presidents. The first one is advance the common good. How do you define advancing the common good? It seems sort of feel good, but is there a real hardcore way of looking at it?
Well, advancing the common good, in our view, is this notion that you need to advance advance policies that support everyone, and primarily the middle class. The middle class, we believe, is the backbone of the country. And when the middle class is supported, the middle class is thriving and robust, the entire country does well, economically speaking.
But everybody says they support the common good. They all think they're supporting the common good. But it's not. So what defines that in terms of how you handle the economy specifically? Lou Goldfarb?
Well, I think you need to look at it on a case-by-case basis as legislation is advanced by presidents and discussed by Congress. How will this impact the American people? And I think what we're saying is pieces of legislation that benefit, by and large, most of the people is legislation that is good for the overall economy.
We've already talked about the middle class as being the engine, which was another one of the rules, but the federal government playing a vital role in the economy. Now, that clearly, you can really see a big separation philosophically between the Democrats and the Republicans when it comes to that. You believe that when the federal government plays a big role, the economy mm-hmm. does better, at least. Mm-hmm. Bob Detrick?
Well, let's look at the answers that the Republicans had to the Great Depression relative to the Democrats. The Republican Party, when the Great Depression took place in the early 30s, keep in mind that how severe that was. The market had actually crashed 89.2% in less than 3 years. Now, what most people don't realize is it wasn't 89.2% to get back to even. When the market has such a big crash, in this particular case, it was 945% just to get back to even. And what Eccles realized is that we had to, dramatically, the government had to get involved to bring demand back. And he believed in this notion that, we had to aggressively borrow money from people who had it, wealthier people, and get it back in the hands of people who would spend it through a lot of different programs that the government ultimately had to implement. Had that not happened, it's very fair to say that the Depression could have continued for another 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And if we had an unemployment at 25% going into World War II, just imagine where we would have been then. Probably not a very good place. We actually brought unemployment down from 25% down to 9.1%. by the beginning of World War II in late December of 1940 or early December of 1941. That was a considerable drop. In fact, that was the fastest drop in unemployment we've ever had, quite frankly. So, and a lot of that, we believe, is attributed to Eccles and FDR.
Dale in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dale.
Yes. What would, with given the current history of the economy in the last 10 years, what would the economy look like today, probably, if Glass-Steagall had not been repealed in 96 under Clinton?
Bob?
Actually, Glass-Steagall was repealed in 98, but good question. And I think it was the combination of the repeal of parts of the Glass-Steagall Act and the passage, it was a Dale, I think, of the Commodity Modernization Act in 1999, Dale, that was the beginning of the problem. That, in tandem with what we did during the Bush years, where we decided to ignore rules on Wall Street like the uptick rule, the naked short selling rule, and so forth, allowed wealthier people vis-a-vis hedge funds to make money on the backs of a lot of other investors. And we feel that was very unfair, that we created an unlevel playing field during the Bush years. That was started, you're right, with the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. But
in essence, a lot of responsibility goes to the fact that that law was not still in act, and that it would play wide and loose with money, as it were.
I mean, I agree. I think that I think that one of the big problems with the last decade was we allowed very important people in government roles, whether it was Hank Paulson or Mike Cox at SEC or Chris Cox at the SEC, just weren't doing their job. And I think that right. was a big problem that led to the Great Recession in 2007, 2008.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Dale. We have an email from Carl. He writes, how many years should a president blame the previous administration for economic problems? Which you do talk about that in the book somewhat. How do you, because you go from beginning of administration to the end of, day one to day, whatever, however many hundreds of days later. How do you justify doing it that way? And what of this blaming the previous administration? Any thoughts?
We don't think the president should blame the previous administration at all. I mean, we think the president takes credit or blame for what happens while they're in office. So in our book, we look at statistics from the day they take office to the day they leave office. It's just like anyone who's being evaluated on their job. What were the results while you were on that job is how you're evaluated. And we think the president, just like anyone else in this world, should be evaluated based upon what happens on his or her watch.
If you take a look at any CEO of any major company, any head football coach or a manager of a baseball team, let's look at Jim Tressel, for example, in 2001. When he came in, he inherited a pretty big mess from Cooper in terms of a lot of academic problems and a lot of disciplinary problems. But what did he do? He came in and turned things around. He brought in an entirely new coaching staff, and he went 7-5, 14-0, and 11-2, I think, in his first 3 years. And had a great result. He didn't have, can you imagine after 3 years if he had losing seasons and then after 3 years said, well, it's not my fault, it's John Cooper's fault. Nobody would have bought it because it would have been utterly untrue. And we believe the same thing is true for the president. Mm-hmm. Despite the situation they inherit, they're responsible for what happens on their watch.
Right. Or Jim Tressel couldn't say, John Cooper, that 7-5 record my first year should be on John Cooper's record. He can't say that.
Conversely.
You're right. Correct.
Yes, but a lot of people defend President Obama right now, saying when he was running for president in 2008, who knew, what was going to happen at the end of the year and going forward, that it would get that bad. I mean, there have been shades of doubt all going all the way back to 2006 and 2007 that there were problems on the horizon, but who knew it would get that bad? And so all the promises he made when he was running for office, a lot of those he didn't keep, and they say it's because, he had to handle this huge problem with the economy when he took over.
Well, we don't really agree that that's the approach that, that the Democrats and Obama should be taking, quite frankly. We believe he should stand on his watch. And if you actually take a look, we actually wrote an op-ed not long ago comparing Ronald Reagan's first term to Barack Obama's first term, Ronald Reagan being kind of the economic icon of the Republican Party. And we use the same 12 data points that we have in our book. And on those 12, actually, Barack Obama's won in his first term, not his second, but his first term, on 8 of those 12 data points. We believe that, again, Obama should stand on that message, and the Democrats should stand on that message, quite frankly.
One of the presidential rules for economic success is take bold action after careful and innovative thought. How do you define innovative?
Well, I think that innovative means being creative. And I think let's go back to FDR and Eccles. I mean, some of the ideas that they came up with in the in 1933 through 35, 36 were some of the most creative and innovative and draconian ideas we've ever seen in this country. Let's take a look at 2008. I think that if you take a look at the Great Recession, as much flack as Ben Bernanke has gotten in this last year for some of the things he's done, I think you can give him a lot of credit for being incredibly creative and innovative in 2008 to make sure that the country didn't fall into an utter abyss, which is about where we were in 2008, by coming up with some of the different methods he came up with to create liquidity in a system that didn't have any. So I think that's really what we mean by being creative or innovative.
Kate, in Mansfield, I'm going to let you ask the next question because I was going to ask it anyway.
Well, I'm really excited to hear about this show and to hear about the book. And I have tried to do my own research at times to convince people that certain presidents have done better. And one of the things I often hear is, well, you can't go by, for instance, what President Clinton did. You have to go by what his Congress did. How do you respond to that?
Lou or Bob Detrick?
Good question. It's Kate, wasn't it? I think.
Kate, yep.
Good question, Kate. I think that one of the keys that we talk about in our book is this notion of compromise and pragmatism. But also a lot of it has to do with leadership, too. If you take a look at those presidents who worked effectively and got things done with their Congress, they were effective presidents. On the other hand, those presidents who did not get along with their own Congresses, who were, by the way, Herbert Hoover, George H.W. Bush, and Jimmy Carter, all, by the way, were also one-term presidents. And I think that that's a very interesting fact, is that when even Hoover could not get along with his own Republican Congress, he couldn't get anything through that he wanted to do, and as a result, he wound up being a one-termer.
Okay, well, how does that bode then for someone like Barack Obama? It's been a complete loggerheads, except for the health care reform, pretty much constantly. And even then, I mean, it was no walk.
You want to take
park.
This one? Or
no, I mean, I think that is where Barack Obama has struggled. And I think if he does get a second term, I think that's the area where he really needs to improve. And obviously it needs to go both ways. We need to have people in Congress, too, who are willing to work with our president. I think over the last 4 years, we've seen more vitriol in Congress toward the president than we've ever seen throughout our history. And that really needs to change. And it all goes back, I think, ultimately, to all the money that's in politics.
Which is a big change, too.
Right. And there's so much money in politics and, you know— these congressmen, congresswomen always have donors who they have allegiance to. And I think that gets in the way of progress for the American people.
Well, and they're always having to raise money.
Right.
And they're always, run again.
Exactly. They're always having to raise money, and they're always, you know, they have ties to their donors, which creates a problem in our political system today. And I think there needs to be a real change in how political campaigns are funded in the future if we're going to see the progress that we need to see for the American people.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks.
Take care. One more of the presidential rules for economic success. Lead as a statesman, not as a partisan. They're running for a whole year or two or three, depending on when you start counting the election cycle. As partisans, they have to go through these incredible primaries now, unless they're an incumbent. How do you take all the promises that you've made to all of the people who voted for you over the course of sometimes 2 and 3 years?
In primaries.
In primaries. Mm-hmm. And then all the statements you've made and then not act on those. Isn't that partisanship, and isn't that what they're supposed to do when they take office?
I think Mitt Romney will find out in about 35 days whether that's going to work or not, because he had to go very, very far to the right to gain his the affiliation or the nomination of his party. And he's really struggled trying to come back to the center. So I think we'll see, we'll quantify that answer this this November, I suspect.
Let's see. An email from Matthew. He writes, in addition to Clinton and the Glass-Steagall Law, Clinton also signed into law the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which Bob, you mentioned, which essentially removed derivatives contracts from regulatory oversight. By many accounts, derivatives such as the credit default swap were at the heart of the financial crisis. Obama's current commercials say that it was the Republicans' deregulation of the financial services industry that drove the financial crisis. Who was it, a Democrat or a Republican?
Well, both take blame. But I think that one of the areas that we talk about considerably in our book under the Bush chapter is how there was very little oversight and transparency during the Bush years when we hired people like Paulson and Chris Cox, who basically were in charge of very important government functions who weren't effectively doing their job. Again, going back to what Christopher Cox did with the removal of the uptick rule, by doing away with the specialist on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, by not enforcing the naked short selling rules for hedge funds and so forth, that created a huge problem, I think, that exacerbated what happened during the late 90s with the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the passage of the Commodity Modernization Act.
So has all that changed now? Are we back to some level where we can get back to business with those kinds of safety nets in place or not?
Not entirely, but let's take a look at the reality of the situation. When Obama came in late, early 09, I should say, the VIX ratings in the terms of the volatility of the markets were at unprecedented levels. We had the VIX at 40, 50, 60, 70, almost as high as 80. Now we're back to where we should be, which is in the mid-teens. So volatility has come down considerably. And when we have a less volatile stock market, we usually create a more consistent, a more predictable and more stable result. And so we've had more predictability under this president than we've had during the prior president by a long shot. And again, Obama should take credit for that, we think.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear revelations from well-known actors, like Zach Galifianakis on the story behind his last name.
It's actually shortened, Terry. My real last name is Galifianakisberg. that's an exclusive for your show.
Fresh Air, bringing you some of the biggest names in American culture and some of the most difficult to pronounce. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides is here with Tech Tuesday. That's from 11 till noon. And you can support WOSU Public Media by becoming a volunteer. We're looking for volunteers to take calls of support from listeners during the upcoming 89.7 NPR News Fall Membership Drive. If you're interested in becoming a volunteer, visit WOSU.org/volunteer. Volunteers, or call 614-292-9678. Showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, a high of 76. More rain tonight, a low of 59. Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, offering perspective in a time of economic uncertainty to help grow and maintain wealth. More information is available online at themontgomerysolution.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about the book Bulls, Bears, and the Ballot Box, how the performance of our presidents has impacted your wallet. Joining us, Bob Detrick and Lou Goldfarb. They are the co-authors of the book, and also with them, Bob Detrick is co-owner of Polaris Financial Partners, and with them as well is Steve Morgan. He's a research analyst and co-owner of Polaris Financial Partners as well. If you have a question or comment for our guests, we welcome them, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Well, let's start out with an email from Hal. He says, I noticed that in 1979-80, the feds let interest rates go sky high, which, along with the hostage crisis, may well have cost President Carter the election. Then in 1984, in time for Reagan's reelection, the Fed cut interest rates drastically. It used to be said that the way the stock market went in January of an election year determined whether an incumbent would be reelected. Which is interesting, consider the Obama conversation we just had. Hal goes on to say, I noticed this year that all of a sudden, after the Republican convention, the stock market is climbing. Have institutional investors and the Fed, which is keeping interest rates at rock bottom, decided to bet on the stability of returning President Obama to office? Bob Detrick, is that the way it works, since that's your job, just to watch those kinds of things?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's fair to say that the Fed is trying to reelect the president. Let's keep in mind who Ben Bernanke is, first of all. Ben Bernanke was one of the lead economists in the Bush administration. He was appointed to the Fed by George W. Bush. He was reappointed by Barack Obama in 2010. So inherently, at least, he's been a Republican during his lifetime. So to say that he's trying to reelect the president, I think, is utterly absurd, and I don't agree with that.
Do you think that the Fed's ever operated that way?
Objectively or subjectively?
Subjectively.
I think they're not supposed to. Their goal is to be nonpartisan, if you will.
Let's get a thesis in the book that's interesting and fun to talk about. You said that the Democrats do a better job on the job pretty much across the board. For 40 years out of the 80, when the Democrats were in control, that's when things were good. Not, you can't say the same for the Republicans, but the Republicans talk a better talk. And that's kind of a subjective analysis. But let's talk a little bit about that, because the perception is that Republicans are better with the economy, they're better with the national defense and that sort of a thing. And you said, yeah, the national defense is another example of how they sell themselves better.
Well, the Republican Party is great at salesmanship, and we say this in the book, that they win the salesmanship merit badge every single year. But at the end of the day, we really don't think that's what the country needs. We need a lot more in the way of statesmanship and a lot less in the way of salesmanship. And when it comes to this notion of messaging and getting very concise messages down for the American people or for their party, they're very good at that, whether it be things like Obamacare or the death tax, which is what they used with John Kerry in 2004, or death panels, which they talked about in 2010 and 2008. They're very good at little short quips that they can get their people to rally around.
You said that the only indicator on which the GOP outperformed Democrats on the economy was in the average annual unemployment rate. And I thought, well, that's not a bad indicator to get stuck holding the bag with, right, Lou Goldfarb? I mean, that's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah. Isn't jobs a big deal?
No, it is a big deal. But I think in order to evaluate presidential performance, you need to look at more than one indicator, which we've done in our book. We've looked at 12 indicators, and 11 of the 12 the Democrats win on. And the one that the Republicans do win on is average annual unemployment. And a lot of that is due to FDR being in office for 12 years presiding over the Great Depression.
So he
does swing it.
Excuse it.
He does swing it to some extent. And so, but I do believe in order to evaluate performance, you need to look at more than just one indicator.
Did any of the Republicans come close to achieving kind of the levels that the Democrats achieved? And conversely, did any of the Democrats come close to failing in this analysis?
Well, Jimmy Carter was not a good steward of our economy. So if you want to look at one Democrat who did not do so well for our economy, it was Jimmy Carter, who had a misery index, which the combination of the unemployment rate and the inflation rate was over 20, which is the highest it's ever been since the misery index was created. So Jimmy Carter had a hard time getting along with his own Congress. As Bob mentioned earlier, those presidents who were able to work with their Congress tended to do better for the economy. And Jimmy Carter could not get along with his own Democratic Congress.
Okay, but neither can with his own Democratic Congress. Mm-hmm. That speaks volumes too. What else did he do wrong?
Jimmy Carter?
Yeah.
Well, for one thing, he had three separate Fed chairmen.
He couldn't get along with his Fed chairman. Okay.
Couldn't decide.
He seems like such a nice guy.
He's a great ex-president.
Yeah, he fired two Fed chairmen before he finally came up with his the last one, which was a success story. But it was too little too late for anything to really materialize. So that was another one of his problems. But at the end of the day, going back to your question, Ronald Reagan and Dwight Eisenhower, two of the better stewards of the economy on the Republican side of the ledger. They both were very effective presidents in many respects.
If you have a question or comment for our guest, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can post your question or comment on Facebook as well if you'd like to. Were you going to say something, Lou?
No, I was going to mention one of the things people maybe don't know about Dwight Eisenhower was he did expand Social Security benefits to 10 million more people than had been eligible for those benefits before he took office. So I think he was one of the Republicans that really believed in that notion of building and strengthening the middle class. And it's one of the reasons he did very well.
Okay, so he was one of those borderline things got better under his watch.
And he refused, despite pressure, to lower taxes on the wealthiest Americans.
Wasn't it during his administration, too, that they expanded the interstate highway system? And that must have dumped
that was
bunch
huge.
Of money.
That was huge for our economy. You talk about stimulating our economy over the years. The interstate highway system has done wonders for the U.S. economy. And that was Dwight Eisenhower who signed that bill.
And that was a big stimulus bill, if you will, that we had in 55, 56 that had a dramatic impact on the economy, not only in the late 50s, but from that point to today.
But they sold it differently as a national defense strategy.
Correct. And that's why it got through
Congress. Once again,
right.
it was a matter of packaging.
Correct.
You say that each president since Herbert Hoover has been a de facto chief executive officer. So this the point being that they are in charge. It isn't Congress. It's really got to be the president. And I know you're looking at that 80-year period, but what was it since Herbert Hoover that changed? What was it before Herbert Hoover?
Well, one of the things we talk about is what led up to the Great Depression. During the Harding and Coolidge years, which were 20 to 28 or early 29, you know, again, we allowed Wall Street to become a casino. We allowed tremendous speculation to take place on Wall Street. And that ultimately led to this huge crash that took place in the summer and fall of 1929 that saw the market go from a peak to a trough where we lost 89, almost 90% in the market. And again, what we've seen, unfortunately, with a lot of Republican administrations is the same notion of boom and bust. If we take a look at the five market crashes we've had, Ann, in the last 80 years, from Herbert Hoover all the way to present day, every single one has happened with a Republican president at the helm. Hoover, Nixon, one during Reagan, and two during George W. Bush. And unfortunately, that seems to be a lot of the problem the Republicans have is this notion of boom and bust. And I think that most people don't really want that in their lives. They prefer a more consistent and a more predictable and a more stable life, if you will, and 401k.
Is there any credence in the idea, though, that to cut taxes for the wealthy is a good thing because it puts money in the hands of the makers, the people who make the jobs and create the jobs? Is there any credence to that? Because I know you mentioned earlier that, well, no, you need to have the money in. You need to have the money in the demand side.
I think you need to have both. I mean, you need to have supply side. You need to have jobs that are created. But I think, in my opinion, most important is having demand. Those jobs will not be created unless there is demand for the products or services.
Demand has to be in equilibrium with supply. That's where we should strive for. This notion that we just look at one side of the equation and ignore the other one doesn't make sense. When demand equals supply, that's when the economy fares well.
A lot has changed in 80 years, obviously. But one of the biggest things is the way we look at our global economy and the demand side when it comes to the global economy. To what extent does that play into this at all and in your analysis?
Well, it does play into the analysis. Things, technologically speaking, we did have a global economy, albeit it was a much slower moving global economy in the 1920s and 30s than it was today. But still, if you take a look at the fundamentals of economics, that has not changed. Economics is a pretty simple message. It's the creation and distribution of income or wealth brought about by the application of labor to raw materials. I mean, that's what Mariner Eccles said back in the 1930s, and that same truth is correct today. Things do move at a much faster pace than they did then, but still the fundamentals of economics still are the same.
And then the way we describe what a job is today is much different as well. We don't have the factory jobs that, and particularly the union factory jobs that I would imagine you would think were kind of the backbone of the economy up through the after the Industrial Revolution and beyond. Those are gone, and they're shrinking all the time. What about that going forward? Lou Goldfarb?
No, I'm sorry.
I think they are. Those types of jobs are eroding. But I will say the manufacturing sector is coming back to some extent under Barack Obama. In fact, in Ohio especially, I mean, if you look up in Youngstown, Ohio, I think it is third in the country in creation of manufacturing jobs in the 4 years that Obama's been president. And a lot, about almost a third of the jobs being created in Ohio are manufacturing jobs. So manufacturing is making a comeback.
In Ohio is one of those states where things have been going better in recent years. And what do you tell voters as far as who to give credit to? Because they're very torn, obviously. Who do you give credit to? A Republican governor, John Kasich?
He wrote an article about that very topic, so I'll let him answer.
A Democratic president?
I actually wrote an op-ed. It appeared in International Business Times about that. Making the point that I don't think there should be a debate who deserves the credit. I firmly believe that Barack Obama should get the credit. 1 in 8 jobs in Ohio are related to the auto industry. And Barack Obama saving the auto industry saved 850,000 jobs here in Ohio. So that action alone has done an awful lot for Ohio's economy, which has at one time was 11% when Barack Obama took office, 11% unemployment. It's down around 7% right now.
7.2.
John Kasich has said, I meet the press, I think back in June, that yes, there were auto jobs saved. You make the point that there's a lot of ancillary jobs out there as well. He said as far as direct auto-related jobs, something like 14 or 1,700 or something like that. And the rest, they're not the high-paying, with good benefits kinds of jobs. So you're talking about 350,000 jobs. What kinds of jobs? It's debatable what kind. And also, is it possible to say that the other one politician did no damage to the other politicians? I mean, no one did harm during this period? And you could have had a Republican or some other Republican governor or some other governor come into office, and could anyone have done damage?
Did John Kasich do damage? I don't think so. I don't have evidence that he did damage, but I think if you're talking about who deserves credit, I think it's primarily Barack Obama's policies, including saving the auto industry, including some of his policies that have enhanced the manufacturing sector. We have, you know, the Lordstown plant in Ohio that now was hiring again. We have 3 shifts working at Lordstown. We have Honda that just invested $98 million in its engine plant in Anna to create 1,200 more jobs. The auto industry is booming. Jeep Wrangler, most of the parts are now made in Ohio. And that's due to Barack Obama. Most people would not have taken the bold and innovative move that Barack Obama did, which was use public dollars to save the auto industry.
What about the assertion?
Which, by the way, Reagan did with Chrysler in the 80s, too, by the way.
That's right. What about the assertion that regulations are job killers? And do we understand or know much about what the real impact of regulations are on the economy?
There needs to be a sensible set of rules and regulations for capitalism to work. And what we talk about in our book is what happened during the 2000s or during the Bush years is we basically, to create an analogy, we took away all the guardrails, took away the stop signs, took away the traffic signs, took the state troopers off the highway, took the county sheriff off the roadways and said, okay, when you guys are out there, just don't make a mess and just don't screw things up. And at the end of the day, that doesn't work. There has to be a reasonable and sensible, not an over, you know, we don't need to over-regulate, but we need to have a reasonable and sensible set of guidelines for capitalism and the free market system to work. And I think Eccles realized that, and so did Reagan and
But I'm talking about
Tip O'Neill too.
Clean air rules and EPA. They're all, you know, Republicans often are critical of the EPA John Kasich, Governor John Kasich.
But who created the EPA and the Clean Air Act? They were started by Richard Nixon in the 70s. I mean, keep that in mind. I think Republicans forget that.
And I think there needs to be, as Bob mentioned, there needs to be sensible regulation. Of course, most businesses are opposed to any regulation if it costs money to comply with those regulations. But we need to have regulations in a civilized society to level the playing field so that all people have opportunities and that our environment is protected, consumers are protected, workers are protected from abuse. So we need to have sensible regulation. I think that's the role of government. is to create sensible regulation. Sometimes, you know, government may go a little too far with regulations. Sometimes they don't go far enough. But that's, I think, one of the benefits of having a two-party system is perhaps by some give and take between the parties, we can come up with some sensible regulations that businesses can live with.
One of the things that we talk about in our book that I'd like Stephen to exacerbate on was is this notion that we don't believe that the government should be there to hold your hand so that if you want to go out and make a crummy investment and lose money, that's one thing. And Stephen, if you want to maybe elaborate on that thought, because
yeah,
we talked
Morgan,
about that extensively when we wrote
you.
The Bush chapter.
it certainly makes sense to have a reasonable set of rules out there. I think ultimately the argument comes down pretty simply to we say these generalities of we need to have a sensible amount of rules and regulations. Everyone has their own idea of what's reasonable. It's just like talking about fairness in general. We hear that a lot when it comes to politics, but everyone has a different idea of what fair is, and that's ultimately the difficulty that comes in and why we have these arguments over regulation all the time.
We're running out of time, but I wonder, just to go back to the congressional issue again, to what extent did it matter or not at all what party controlled Congress from one president to the next? Did you look at that at all?
We did indeed. And actually, there have been only really two fundamental times where there was a Republican Congress with the House and Senate and a Republican in the White House, and they were the Hoover years, and they were the Bush years from 2001 through 2007. We also had a brief period of time where the Republicans held, you know, one side of Congress back in the 1940s during the Truman years. But at the end of the day, predominantly it's been a Democratic Congress and a Republican or a Democrat in the White House. So
mostly Democratic Congress.
Mostly Democrats have been in the Congress, correct, predominantly. But let's take a look, too, at what happened during those periods of time where we had those crashes we talked about. We had Hoover with the Republican Congress, which caused and exacerbated the crash in the 1920s, early 30s. And then, you know, we had one crash in 2002 and another one in 2007, 2008 with a Republican Congress for 6 of the 8 years that Bush was in.
Well, we'll have to let the listeners make up their own mind. If you want to check out the book, Bulls, Bears, and the Ballot Box, How the Performance of Our Presidents Has Impacted Your Wallet. I've been talking with Bob Detrick, co-author of the book, with Lou Goldfarb. Lou is a CPA and professor at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. And Bob is co-owner of Polaris Financial Partners, and with us, Steve Morgan as well, co-owner of Polaris Financial Partners. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Ann. We appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.